This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Okay, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. Her name is Cynthia Chung, and she's just published a book. I read most of it. The title of the book is The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set, The Birth of International Fascism and the Anglo-American Foreign Policy. And it was published November 6, 2022. Today is November 30th. There will be two volumes. So this is the first volume, and it's available now on Kindle and paperback. And she's also been a researcher and co-author of a three-volume series titled The Clash of the Two Americas. The titles are, one, The Unfinished Symphony, two, Open and Closed, First Closed Systems Collide, and three, The Birth of a Eurasian Manifest Destiny. And that was with her husband, Matthew Ehret, who E-H-R-E-T, who I also interviewed about Canadian history. So you can go back, and I'll put that link into my interview with him in these show notes. And she has a Substack that you can read her work at, and it's Through a Glass Darkly. But again, we're going to talk about this book, The Empire of the Black Sun, on which the Black Sun never set. So Cynthia Chung, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So for people who may not have heard your name or some of your earlier work, do you mind just going through your background and what led you up to publishing this book, The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set?
Well, my background is really more based in literature and drama and philosophy. Those are actually my true love. But I started to write political articles 2019, largely for Strategic Culture Foundation. And it was a very useful thing because I actually learned a lot actually by asking myself questions that I wanted the answers to, and I would go ahead and read up and do research. And that was my orientation in kind of sharing these kinds of insights that I would gain through a lot of the reading, because I think a lot of people are probably in a similar boat to mine, where a lot of people are not that interested in politics, but we've kind of hit a situation today where we're in such a crisis that whether we like it or not, it really is our responsibility at this point to inform ourselves as to how we got into a situation today, which is very much a totalitarian oriented system here in the West. And so through my political writings, I started to piece together certain things, and I decided to release this book largely because I did this five-part series instigated by Russia's intervention into Ukraine. There was a lot of confusion as to what was going on at that point, and so that instigated me to do a five-part essay. And it ended up turning into a book in terms of this larger question of did fascism really disappear, as we're told, after World War II? And it was really an issue of defending the free world against the so-called communist boogeymen. And it's been a narrative that has been repeated pretty much nonstop until today. And it's a really big problem because from what I have found out in my research is that it is not originated in this. It's not to say that, communism is innocent. It's actually quite complex because there are elements of communist branches that were working with the fascists, but the root of what we find ourselves in today is very much an origination of old idea of empire that is situated from Europe and has, had these various attempts to reboot, revive a world order based on a concept of empire. And as soon as people, I think, become more informed that that is really the root of where our problems are situated, it's something that has basically successfully taken over most of the Western democratic institutions at this point. There isn't really a true democratic functioning system at this point. It was something that occurred from within. It was waged in a clandestine way after World War II. And the policies that were pushed post-World War II were the very same policies that the people like Mussolini and Hitler were in support of, in terms of, you know, the League of Nations concept of pan-Europe, which we can probably get into in a little bit, which was the idea behind the European Union. But this was going to be the model for the entire world. Was these six regions of empire, but all overseen by the British Empire to be the ultimate, you know, alpha in this situation. So with us understanding this, I think that people will be less likely to be manipulated by the kind of false news that's coming out right now, which is constantly blaming the woes of, the infringement on civil liberties from, you know, the same old story that it's the communists that are constantly infiltrating our system, when it's clear that it actually is something akin to what I was just talking about.
Right. So the empire, your title is a play on the statement of the British Empire, the empire on which the sun never set, right? They had Australia, Canada, where you and your husband are, then India as well, South Africa. So all these after world, I mean, and you really kind of start leading up to World War II, but once World War II happens, you think that the empire really didn't ever end. It just changed and morphed. Like, you're a kind of a believer of, and I think you make a great case for it in the book, that the ideals of the British Empire infiltrated the U.S. after World War II, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes. Well, the thing that people have to understand as well is that I'll do like a quick overview here. My approach to history is that the United States really did put forward an economic orientation a la, you know, kind of a Henry C. Carey Centennial Exhibition, the machine tool industry, which allowed the United States to be the most powerful country within 100 years of its origin. They had set up an economic system that was unique in history. And it was the first time that something could really feasibly compete against a system of empire. So the British Empire was saw what lay ahead for it in terms of the consequences of this, and that the American system, which is what is referred to in this school of economics, the Centennial Exhibition that was organized by Henry C. Carey was specifically to invite other countries to adopt this very policy. So it's very counter to kind of like how America is oriented today. But they wanted to share these because the idea was that if you promoted sovereign nation states, this was going to be the cure to end imperialism. When you have countries that have an economic independence, that's your best way to secure security, to secure your future, stability and so forth, to have opportunity for your people. So there was a lot of partnerships that were forming at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century with the United States, Germany, Russia, China, Japan were like the really big ones, but there were other countries as well. And there's a lot of evidence to show that the First World War was instigated to break up these partnerships. The system of empire was already getting bankrupt and collapsing. So after the First World War, empires also collapsed, and you had the origins of like new republics. These new republics were not very strong. And immediately you had Woodrow Wilson, who you started to get some really bad presidents in the United States, especially after Lincoln's assassination. You know, you had Garfield's assassination, you had McKinley's assassination. You had bad presidents like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who were for essentially a British foreign policy. And Woodrow Wilson was for this League of Nations concept, which was basically this idea of a reboot for a world empire, these six regionalizations, but with Britain at the head, and this idea of segregation as well, this idea that ethnicity should be segregated based off of like where you're supposed to be in your origin country or so forth.
Right. And like three empires died in World War One, right? So it was, I think, the German Empire, Russian Empire, I think Austria-Hungarian. Right? Yeah. So all three of those were wiped off the map. Yeah. So it was really was a time of great change.
The Ottoman Empire too, like, died before. Right. And yeah, so you had this scramble to kind of, because even though there was the republics, there was nothing secure. And it was very easy to just reboot according to who was going to be the main organizers. And that's where you have this character, Richard Coudenhove-Kalergi, who played a very big role in organizing for this League of Nations concept, or, you know, this idea of what they called the United States of Europe as well. They were using this dishonest form of language, because, you know, the United States, with their economic system, they were able to unite 13 colonies so that they could trade and they could have a banking system that communicated with itself efficiently, so that they could, you know, facilitate their economic needs, which makes sense when you're within a country to do those things. And Germany was also adopting this with their Zollverein. But the play on words and the dishonesty was that they were saying that this was thus going to be implemented for Europe. What that essentially meant was the very opposite, that instead of promoting sovereign nation states with sovereign economies, that instead you were going to turn the countries of Europe into effectively colonies of a central order. It was the reverse, but they were, you know, calling it the United States of Europe, with Europe being now the big so-called country. And so Kalergi was very much pushing this. This was one of the components to the League of Nations concept. So this was going to be one piece of the chessboard that would be an empire. Kalergi clearly viewed it as a sort of revival of an Austro-Hungarian empire, you could say. There's also elements as well, like he catered to the supporters of Hitler for pan-Germanism. He was also catering to Mussolini's imperialistic views. You know, a lot of people, they seem to forget that the fascists were actually very clearly in support of an imperial outlook. And Mussolini was also looking at Africa as the slave labor for all of Europe.
I thought it was interesting that Kalergi was from a crusader family,
yeah,
and literally used the ethos and imagery of the Crusades, because yeah, that's what bound all of the states of Europe and all the elites together in a concerted effort back in that time, right?
It's unsettling, because there's an element of what you can call Christian fascism in terms of how Kalergi and a lot of people who were in support of this kind of Christian fascism, they all very much romanticized this concept of the Crusades. And the Vatican was, you know, involved in this under Pope Pius the 12th as well, in support of fascism, to the point where Kalergi even says in his autobiography, because Pope Pius the 12th never criticized fascist Italy, he's like, why would Pope Pius the 12th do that? Catholicism is inherently fascist. So not to say that that is true, right? But there was a lot of Catholics that were actually, you know, working with the fascists, compared to, I guess you could look at other branches. And the Crusade orientation played a big part in this. I don't know if we'll have time to go over it in this interview, but there was this whole thing too of like how the fascists were involved in bringing about the British Mandate of Palestine, which, you know, clearly set off a whole bunch of problems, you know, for the Middle East, and again had a crusade type connection to this, but with a very long-term orientation, of course. But yes, Kalergi had the crusade symbol for his pan-Europe flag, and there's later on he puts the stars around this crusade symbol with a blue background, and the European Union flag seems to have taken the star circle concept from Kalergi, but they don't. It's like almost like the crusade symbol is there, but hidden, you know, under blue.
It's
like unspoken.
But in this original circle, it was the cross of Christ on the blue, son of Apollo, or whatever I think you wrote. But yeah, exactly, it was an interesting imagery. But he also was looking at, like you said, Zionism, pan-Islamism. So these kind of pan movements of trying to put larger groups together, pan-Arabism and stuff like that, were his idea of trying to get the Europeans to fuse together, which eventually happened, right? I mean, not in his lifetime, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's like a good idea behind uniting, you know, for instance, the Arab people to a common cause. Like, you know, for instance, I think that Nasser was right to say that because the problem with the Middle East is that the British, largely the French as well, they came in, right? This is what the Sykes-Picot carving up of the Middle East created, but they decided how the countries were going to be split up in the Middle East, so that they had certain kinds of false monarchies that they put over the areas that had the resources, the oil. And they had like other types, allowed other types of, I guess, formation of governments in other areas. And so, you know, what you had was that all of the heavy resource areas had these like British puppet monarchs that were sitting over top of them. And Nasser was just making the point that this is the resources of all of the people of Arabia. And it should be used for the benefit of the people, which I don't think is a bad idea. But there's been also dangerous ideas of pen whatever, which has been used to instigate extremism and radicalization. But in order to understand any of this, really, like, people have to understand Gladio, which I guess we skipped a few steps because that's further into the book. But I wanted to make a point too that I start off the book explaining British fascism, because you know, I think a lot of people know that you had Edward VIII, who was very openly pro Hitler, and I don't think a lot of people actually know that David Lloyd George, who was a prime minister during the Sykes-Picot time, during the establishment of the British Mandate of Palestine, was also very openly pro-fascist. And then you had the notorious Oswald Mosley. But the reality of the situation was that a good chunk of the supposed allies in Britain were also for the fascist system. And the scary thing is that many people within Europe, high-level ranking people and institutions, were actually pro-fascist, including within the United States as well. And so there was really, you can see there's a level of arrogance that it was just going to happen. And one of the a clear indication for this is James Burnham, who is the spiritual father of neoconservatism for the United States. He wrote The Managerial Revolution. He did not prophesize the technocratic H.G. Wells, you know, scientific fascism. He was basically an acolyte of Bertrand Russell, so he was taking his orders from him, but he play-acted as a Trotskyist right-hand man. It's a very interesting story, but he, when he was writing The Managerial Revolution, he's basically telling Americans, hey, we just have to accept that fascism is here to stay, basically, right? Because they were just so confident that this was going to happen. It was going to succeed.
Hadn't earned itself a kind of a negative, pejorative perception at that time. So fascism was kind of like more edgy prior to World War II, I think, than people saw its downsides, right? I mean, so
well,
I think that...
Yeah, when he wrote it in 41, it was still pretty controversial. And there were a lot of people who criticized him, rightfully so. of because there was a lot of people like Bertrand Russell was also saying, like, why even resist? Like, we shouldn't go to arms against them. And if you look at how the Second World War was started, you have like the first 6 months that are called the phony war, because there was not actually any fighting. And the fighting only started when Germany entered France. It was very clear that they didn't want to resist it. They wanted like as quick and as painless of a transition as possible to fascism. And Kalergi clearly complains about the anti-fascist resistance, you know, in his autobiography, because he feels that, you know, the war wouldn't have been necessary if people had just accepted what was, you know, good for them. But that's the reality. It was really Roosevelt and Stalin who pushed back on this in any kind of serious way. I challenge anyone to say who else, you know, was instrumental in that. And Roosevelt had a lot of pushback. Churchill had delayed the United States entry into the war quite a bit. And then he also had a lot of opposition within the United States as well. Even to this day, it's weird. Like, people are critical of Roosevelt, you know, entering the Second World War, and yet they're not supporters of Hitler. And it's like, well, what did you think was going to happen? Like, it was a situation where if the United States hadn't come in, and the United States was instrumental in giving the resources for Russia to fight the Wehrmacht, everyone thought that the Wehrmacht was going to win within 3 weeks of, you know, fighting the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would not have been able to resist for years if it wasn't for Roosevelt sending a bunch of like hundreds of pieces of equipment that the Soviet Union required to defend itself. So, yeah, that's not really talked about. But then when World War II was won, immediately the Nazis were brought in to NATO. They were brought into the surveillance structure. So in West Germany, they had Reinhard Gehlen in charge of the Western German security apparatus, intelligence apparatus, a high-ranking, you know, Nazi who was in charge of overseeing intelligence for the Nazis. And you had Franz Six, who was responsible for the plan for the Nazi British invasion. He was put into Germany. Like, all of these, you have Otto Skorzeny too, who was put in charge of the secret armies of NATO. And he was also played a big role in also using Gladio training in the Middle East. So a lot of these, like, later on terrorists, like from the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth, they actually were trained directly by Nazis to continue their kind of terrorist tactics within the Middle East. You had a support from many people within the Middle East, because even to this day, there's confusion from them that the Nazis were going to free them from imperialism. But if you look at everything that the Nazis did, they broke their promises constantly, and they were for a clearly view of a German empire. And it was just that they didn't ever get to the point of reaching the Middle East, but they would have clearly screwed over the Middle East people like they did with the Ukrainian people. Stepan Bandera and Mykola Lebed worked with the Nazis, and they thought that, you know, Stepan Bandera thought that he would be the new leader of Ukraine as long as he, you know, bowed the knee to Emperor Hitler, and they put him in a concentration camp, and like they killed a bunch of their members and so forth. And still today, Ukraine like acts like that didn't happen. It was like the Soviets who took away their freedom and everything.
And so Bandera was a genocidal maniac, killed tens of thousands of people, responsible, I think, for killing Poles and Jews. And
just Ukrainians who disagreed with him. Even just Ukrainians who didn't want his view, and that the OUN ended up splitting, you know, between Stepan Bandera and Mykola Lebed, and they were also fighting each other. So it was like, it was warlords, you know, like it was not for the best interest of the people. But the thing is that the CIA, you know, Stepan Bandera, he eventually was killed, but Mykola Lebed was really propped up by the CIA through aerodynamic. There's been a lot of declassified records of the Nazis and the Japanese fascists in the late 90s, so that now we know about this aerodynamic operation from CIA, where they were using Mykola Lebed to continue to pump this kind of propaganda and this kind of radicalization into the Ukraine throughout the Cold War years, to with the intention always to use Ukraine as a Cold War weapon against the against Russia. They never cared about the Ukrainians, and Mykola Lebed as well. He attacked Ukrainian people as well that were not Jewish, that were not of Russian ethnicity. So it has nothing even to do with like a loyalty to Ukrainian people. It's just about being a warlord. It's about power for those types of people. But they are romanticized, and the history is revised and made to look like these people, you know, never cooperated with the Nazis, which is clearly provable that they did, and so forth.
There were a lot of Ukrainian people who were on board, and even Romania too, were on board with Nazis. There were black guards and all kinds of significant elements of that society, no question about it. It's not, and then you can take it all the way to the present day, right? I mean, there's still this Azov battalion. You list other groups too, but they're still. I mean, when Stalin says he's fighting Nazis, he's literally fighting Nazis on the that are there on the eastern part of Ukraine, right?
Stalin or Putin?
I'm sorry, I meant Putin. When Putin says, wrong person. When yeah. Putin says that he's fighting National Socialists, he really is, isn't he?
Yeah, and like again, he is fighting Nazis. What people need to understand too is this whole labeling of National Socialism. I don't know if we have time to go into it, but the Fabian Society is very important in understanding. The reason why people get so confused is because they don't understand the permeation technique. And the Fabian Society is a very big player next to the Round Table, which, you know, set up the Chatham House, the British Institute for implementing a lot of these ideas. The Council for Foreign Relations is the American branch of this British institution. And they basically are the grand strategists of Britain that were very, very smart. And these policies have continued to play the dominating role in what shapes world politics today. But the Fabian Society had called themselves Marxist Darwinists. Initially, right? Like Bertrand Russell was talking about, you know, pro-Marxist ideas and everything. He later on became an avid anti-Marxist, as you see also with people like James Burnham, Max Eastman, like a lot of these really famous American Trotskyists. They all were like mentored by John Dewey, who is in connection with Bertrand Russell and all of this. And then they all later become avid anti-communist to the point where they are the most extreme in their McCarthyist ideas of like what should happen to communists. And this is obviously not just a coincidence that it was a game. They were never actually Marxists to begin with. And you have people like Georges, I'm not defending Marxism, by the way, but they were turning Marxism into something that was even further weaponized as a fascist imperialist tool. And you have Georges Sorel, who was one of the first to, like, he was basically the a huge influence on fascist Italy. And he was the one who revised Marxism such that socialism could be fit into a fascist construct. That was like a very open intention of his. And so that's why you see as well Kalergi, the guy for the Crusade for Pan-Europe, he was not only trying to organize fascists around this like idea of how to go about strategically reinstitutionalizing world empire, but he was also going to Marxists to support this. The Second International, you have like Trotsky, Bakunin, Prince Kropotkin, these types of players were actually all playing on the same team as the fascists. You also had communists who were actually fighting fascists, like in Italy and Greece. And these were the communists that were attacked later on by NATO's secret armies. And there were terrorist attacks that were launched on the European people by NATO's secret armies. This is well documented at this point. A lot of this information came out at the beginning of the 21st century, you know, in the early 2000s. And Daniel Ganser's book, NATO's Secret Armies, is a very extensive overview of this. The reality was that you had these secret armies after World War II, with Nazis and fascists also being a huge component of this. NATO was also run, the Central Eastern Command of NATO was run by former Nazis for 16 years straight. These were used to defend the free world against communism, but we now know it's acknowledged that these terrorist attacks were not actually launched by the communists, but were actually launched by NATO secret armies. So
there were false flag attacks, right? Well, it wasn't clarified, and there were ones all over Italy, Belgium. There were a lot of them, right?
Yeah, well, Italy has what is termed the years of lead. It was like 20 years. It's probably over 20 years of this nonstop terror. And the OPC branch of the CIA, which was set up by Frank Wisner and Alan Dulles, who are, again, I go over in the book that they were clearly working with the Nazis and the Italian fascists, but they set up this rogue branch. The Frank Church Senate Committee hearings even put this on record, that the OPC was originated largely to interfere in the elections of Europe, so that after World War II, they would not tolerate a democratic decision to support anything left-leaning, and that they were instrumenting these kinds of terrorist attacks, blaming it on the communists in order to justify far-right support. And you have, you know, Operation Northwood as well, that was brought forward by General Lemnitzer in the United States. Kennedy rejected it, but people can look it up. It's on Wikipedia, where he was also proposing this very same thing for the United States, where he was saying the United States should attack its citizens and its military, some, you know, as like mock attacks and some as real attacks on its citizens, and blame it on the Cubans to justify a Cuban invasion. And you can look it up on Wikipedia. Like, these were actual things that were going on. In the case of the Northwood plot, Kennedy rejected it, but it's not to say that those things were not happening. You know, COINTELPRO, you know, is involved in a lot of these types of things as well, in terms of creating these problems and then blaming it on other agencies. And it's the same game that we have, that we see playing today, but it's essentially the Fabian technique, where you have, you know, you go into a grouping and you basically, you know, break it apart, and you divide it, you splinter it, and you try to recruit the most extreme faction of it to your cause. So a lot of these, what looks like to be, you know, like you have like Nazis, Italian fascists, you have Wall Street, City of London type people, you have the imperialists like Churchill, Leo Amery, and then you have like terrorists and so forth, but they're all ultimately working for the same agenda. I mean,
it is fascinating. Just sorry to interrupt, but I really was intrigued by that passage you had in your book, where in Belgium, the Gladio team there was involved in blackmail, sexual blackmail, really dark stuff. And it was leading up to the time right of the Dutroux, right? I think Dutroux was late 80s. So you could possibly see an overlap between these blackmail groups. And there were violent things that happened in Belgium. Like, somebody walked in from one of these Gladio groups and shot a bunch of people in like a shopping mall, if I remember correctly. But It is fascinating that they were using those techniques even before Dutroux. So I wonder if Dutroux and some of his cronies were involved in something like that too. But yeah, also, I also did research on a Gladio group in the UK called Combat 18, where one of these Nazis was literally a member of that. His name was David Myatt. So they did exist. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have the information on them, just like you said.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't have to call yourself a Nazi to be like a fascist imperialist, like Churchill was a fascist imperialist. But, you know, France played the origins of NATO, for instance. NATO's insignia, the compass rose, comes from the French secret army that was exposed 2 years before NATO's formation. And there are definitely occult elements to the Gladio operation, which Volume 2 is going to go more into the occult aspects of this story. The Volume 1 was focusing much more on like just having a geopolitical kind of grounding before going into that, because it can be quite confusing and disorienting if you don't have that. But, you know, de Gaulle, I think, is a very good case study to show how bad the Gladio NATO secret army became, and NATO itself, where, you know, NATO and Gladio, you have like the CIA, MI6, the OAS, which is the rogue, you know, French intelligence branch. They were all trying to have de Gaulle assassinated, and it reached a point where de Gaulle kicked NATO out of France. And he said, you know, basically France has to have control over this thing, that the headquarters were in France, or get out. And that's why, you know, NATO ended up moving to Belgium, and then Belgium, you know, started to have all of these weird problems like you were describing.
Right.
It's
interesting. Sorry to interrupt, but it was interesting. Another aspect of your book, what I learned is he knew himself in the context of JFK. Like he said, that could have been me, right? Or something to that effect.
Yeah, like exactly.
I think his assassination attempt was 1962.
Well, and there was a OAS member, Jean Souettre. Well, there was over 30 assassination attempts against de Gaulle. But Jean Souettre, who was a prominent OAS member, he was in Dallas, Texas the day of Kennedy's assassination, and they, you know, basically let him go to Mexico without any kind of, you know, withholding or interrogation. And de Gaulle was basically saying, yeah, this is the same grouping that was trying to get rid of me. And I go through in detail, like the branches that were involved in this for Kennedy's murder. And so it's, I mean, it wasn't just Kennedy, though. There were like there were several democratically elected leaders within Europe that were assassinated, or they had soft coups against them, which are character assassinations. It's very similar to, again, what we have going on today, where you are dishonestly accused of being like in bed with the Soviets or whatever, so that people then, you know, look at you as a problem when, in fact, you are actually just holding you're upholding a democratic constitution. And that is the problem, because they wanted a fascist totalitarian system. So it wasn't communism, really. It was this idea of sovereign nation states at the end of the day that was enemy number one. And they were using these excuses. They were falsely labeling many people. I mean, look at McCarthyism. I think most people recognize that McCarthyism was attacking a lot of people who were not like communists. And it was because you were saying things that the state didn't want you to say. And so you could just be labeled whatever. It's very similar to today. You can be just labeled whatever. And then just like that, whatever you have to say doesn't count, no matter what the evidence you present to support your case. So it becomes increasingly hard to expose what is the corruption, the scandal, if you're silencing all of these people with these like very lazy labels.
True, no doubt. Yeah. So it's happening today. Character assassination and blackmail's all over. I mean, the whole Epstein thing was a huge blackmail operation. Successful, I might add too. I think a lot of these people or around today are totally blackmailed. But the assassinations of that time were really were astonishing. How many heads of state were killed, even in the U.S., but even around that time, worldwide, Lumumba, attempted assassinations on Castro over and over, definitely Allende. So it was a much more brutal. And a lot of those were for fascist goals, right? So that agenda was still there, even post-war, post-World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think people might be interested to know that this also this idea of a technocratic system, a system based off of scientific fascism, was also something discussed very early on in the 1920s and even earlier. And that H.G. Wells, the Fabian Society, again, plays a prominent role in this. H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, Oswald Mosley himself said in writing that he was using H.G. Wells's view of scientific fascism as what should be implemented, you know, in a post-World War II world. So people should learn from this that, like, where we're at today is not some new foreign intervention into how our Western construct works, but rather what the reality of the situation is that after World War II, we were told that we had defeated fascism, but in reality, the fascists were allowed to be reintegrated into all of the top-down structure of the Western sphere. And there was, so they had the institutions, and then you had this clandestine silent war, and they used the excuse of a Cold War to justify what we did find out about. And there's a lot that we still, you know, don't know about these sorts of things. So where we are today, people should really not regard it as something new, or that, like, oh, China has all of a sudden controlled every little element within our society, and they're infiltrating the elections and so forth. When you look at the historical trend of Anglo-America, this is precisely what they've been doing for a whole century at this point. And we would be very foolish to not recognize that problem from within. And if we fail to recognize that problem from within, we're going to obviously suffer for that failure. It's going to be a harder future than it needs to be for us. Like, the solution is actually quite simple. If the people were to just recognize the source of how the system has been kind of taken over, so that it is this totalitarian system at this point that does not respect civil liberties. But the nice thing about the United States is that it does have a positive aspect of its history that we can learn from, especially the economic orientation, right, of Roosevelt's New Deal, for instance. There's a reason why Keynes, who was a pro-fascist, tried to have his own version of a New Deal, which he said himself when it was published in Nazi Germany, that his version was best suited for a totalitarian system. This was to offset what Roosevelt was trying to work towards. So there's the United States still is a model for the economic solutions against empire. We just have to revisit those things. We have to remind ourselves about what that is. And I think that once we understand what is a proper economic orientation, which again is also based, that's centered on how you define humankind, where the individual is a sacred, useful, productive element of society that can increase wealth. That's the real wealth of a country, is its individual, the potential for good of an individual, rather than the system of empire that looks at the individual as a problem, and that population growth is a problem. We need to promote depopulation. This is why you have things like Yuval Harari talking about the problem of useless eaters in an increasingly technocratic society and so forth. The reason why they feel that they can justify these increasingly uglier and uglier ideas, like healthcare, we don't have the money to give you treatment, or we don't have the technology, which is not true either, to give you treatment. So how about you accept euthanasia instead? this is increasingly the sort of line that we're being given, all of these excuses for why we can't have like the basics for a decent human, you know, beings, you know, the expectation of what you would have for a decent life. And this is all false scarcity. It's all, and it's a false situation of terror. It's a false situation of scarcity. And if people were to recognize that, you could so easily exit out of this box that's like increasingly getting smaller and smaller on people if they could recognize that.
It's true. Climate change, all that stuff, all the you'll eat bugs, be happy, the propaganda, like you're there. We're right back at some kind of weird fascism too. We're at about 45 minutes. Cynthia, do you have time for a few questions?
Yeah, sure.
Gameplay asks, did anyone working with the Nazis after World War II take a step back and consider what they were actually doing? Do you know?
As in, like, were there any Nazis who then became outspoken anti-Nazis? I don't know of any, but I mean, it's kind of like, you know, no one can freely talk about the child sex rings, right? That were the pedophilia rings. Like anyone who was like part of that, it's like very hard to find any, like there's a lot of people that seem to want to, you know, come forward on these types of things, but there are certain subjects that are just so tightly, you know, controlled that you wouldn't get very far. Oftentimes these people, you know, are probably assassinated. But in terms of a prominent Nazi that attempted to blow the lid off of this, I'm not aware of anyone.
Yeah, the Dutroux, like there were like 25 deaths around the whole Dutroux case, people being buried in gardens and stuff like that. We Steals Play-Doh Snakes asks, are you aware that Gavin Newsom's father was a pal of Otto Scorsese?
No, I didn't.
Oh, interesting. Do you have any insight into the occultism of the Nazis? Do you address that? Like, I know the Sonnenrad is huge. It was at Babelsberg, Himmler's kind of SS center. I mean,
right now I'm like in the process of looking into it, but because I haven't actually like put together a paper myself, and that's like when my ideas are the most organized is once I actually try to compose something. I'm going to refrain from talking about it right now because it's such a massive subject. Like it's one of those subjects that I've read the most without being ready still to write about it because gotcha. There's just so much to it. But again, volume 2 is going to focus on that. And hopefully within like a month or two, I will start putting out my first papers that will be talking about Nazi occultism before the book is even released.
And that's going to be on your Substack, correct?
I publish also with like, you know, Strategic Culture Foundation, some other outlets sometimes, but all of my writing you can find on my Substack page through A Glass Darkly. Yeah.
And then what are your thoughts on occult Duganism? Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
Great. And then, see, I mean, I think that there's a lot of extra stuff in this book. Like, you have a lot of information on a variety of different subjects we didn't even get into. Heroin in Florida, fascism, Mockingbird. People would be interested in reading about that. And a lot on Ukraine, too. A lot of stuff, current stuff, things of current importance. But where is the best place for people to get The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set?
Well, it's presently available on Amazon. It will soon be available on Barnes & Nobles. And for people who want to not go through those outlets, you can buy the PDF directly off of me. And you can just go to my Substack page again through Glass Darkly and write in asking for the PDF version.
Excellent. So you can buy directly from the author. And I'll put a link to that Substack as well. But thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Again, I highly recommend this book, The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set, The Birth of International Fascism and Anglo-American Foreign Policy. by Cynthia Chung, just published November 6, 2022. This is the first volume of two volumes. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Stay there.